From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, we talk about the unspeakable, what happens to the body after death. It's the subject of Dr. Kenneth Iserson's new book, Death to Dust. He says he wrote it for anyone who is afraid to donate his organs after death out of fear it will mutilate his body. Iserson says death is a mutilating experience. Also today, we talk with Murray Kempton. He was described in The New Yorker as the greatest of all living newspapermen. For many years, he was with The New York Post. He now writes a column for New York Newsday. His columns and essays are collected in the new book, Rebellions, Perversities, and Main Events. And filling in for Stephen Schiff, critic Kevin Whitehead reviews two new movies about college life, With Honors and PCU. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. Relief groups in Rwanda say heavy shelling can be heard in Kigali, the capital. A new surge of fighting has been reported. The International Red Cross says militiamen have killed 34 Rwandan children and Red Cross workers at an orphanage. The British relief group Oxfam is pleading with the United Nations to send troops back into Rwanda to protect civilians from slaughter. At least 100,000 Rwandans have been killed. Defense Secretary William Perry says North Korea's nuclear program is at a critical juncture. If Pyongyang goes ahead with plans to change a nuclear reactor fuel core tomorrow, and international inspectors aren't there, Perry says the United States will refer the matter to the United Nations. NPR's Ann Garrels reports.
U.S. officials say inspectors must be there when the fuel core is changed for two reasons: to establish how much weapons-grade plutonium North Korea may have produced in the past, and to prevent North Korea from reprocessing more plutonium from this spent fuel in the future. Defense Secretary Perry said a refueling of the reactor would force the U.S. to press for U.N. sanctions. However, should North Korea let inspectors in, Perry said there would be economic and political rewards. North Korea has warned that sanctions would be tantamount to a declaration of war. While Perry said the U.S. is not trying to threaten North Korea militarily, he said it's taken additional defensive steps, and he said there's no doubt the combined forces of Korea and the U.S. could directly defeat an attack from the North. I'm Ann Garrels in Washington.
The Illinois Supreme Court has rejected convicted serial murderer John Wayne Gacy's request for a stay of execution. He's convicted of killing 33 boys and young men. Gacy is scheduled to die a week from today, but his lawyers think they can put off the execution by one day. NPR's Edward Lifson reports from Chicago.
Illinois' highest court was blunt. In a brief three-sentence order, it rejected the argument that Gacy had new evidence proving he was out of town at the time of at least some of the murders, and that he is mentally unfit for execution. But there are at least three other last-minute appeals designed to delay the execution. Gregory Adamski is one of Gacy's attorneys.
John Gacy has a petition filed in the federal district court for writ of habeas corpus to overturn his conviction and to stop his death sentences. It means that the state has to justify why it's holding John Gacy.
The federal court is expected to rule in that case on Friday, but already a spokesman for the Illinois Attorney General's office is saying that there is no further legal basis to delay the May 10th execution of Gacy. In Chicago, I'm Edward Lifson reporting.
The African National Congress will have to wait three extra days to take power in South Africa. That's because ballot counting is taking so long, only half the votes have been counted. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials are up 9 points at 3,710. Trading is heavy. This is NPR News. Italian prosecutors are investigating the racetrack manager of the Marino Grand Prix on suspicion of culpable homicide. Two drivers died in car crashes over the weekend. One of them was champion racer Ayrton Senna. NPR's Silvio Pugioli reports from Rome.
Italian prosecutors have formally informed the managing director of the Imola racetrack, Federico Bendinelli, that he is under investigation. Also included in the probe are the race organizer, legal representatives of the Williams-Renault car maker, and of the company that makes the helmet Senna was wearing during the race. The 34-year-old Brazilian three-time Formula One world champion was leading the race Sunday when his car failed to make a turn and crashed head-on into a concrete barrier at an estimated speed of 186 miles per hour. It is still not clear why his car left the track. Senna was pronounced dead a few hours later at the Bologna hospital. Only the day before, Austrian driver Roland Ratzenberger was killed during qualifying rounds on the Imola track. Senna's death has stunned the racing world, and the Brazilian government has declared 3 days of mourning for its native racing idol. This is Silvia Poggioli in Rome.
Eastman Kodak says it's going to sell its pharmaceutical subsidiary, Sterling Winthrop, and two other divisions. Kodak has been pressured by its shareholders to improve its financial performance. Its board forced out Chairman Kay Whitmore last August because the firm wasn't making enough progress. Kodak says it will refocus on its core photography and imaging businesses. Authorities in Southern California are warning beachgoers away from a 15-mile stretch of Pacific coast. A pipeline has burst in Tijuana, Mexico, and at least 24 million gallons of raw sewage have poured into the ocean. Mexican officials hope to repair the pipeline today. San Diego has been struggling with the effects of sewage from Tijuana for many years. I'm Corva Coleman, NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. We're going to talk about a subject some people consider unspeakable. What happens to a body after death? My guest has a good reason for talking about it. He thinks if people understand this, they will be more likely to donate their organs after death. I'll explain in a moment, but I should advise you some listeners might find the explicit nature of our interview disturbing. Dr. Kenneth Iserson directs the Arizona Bioethics Program at the University of Arizona, where he's also a professor of surgery. He practices emergency medicine and is the medical director of Southern Arizona's major search and rescue operation. In his new book, Death to Dust, What Happens to Dead Bodies, he says that approximately 25 different organs and types of tissues can be used for transplant now, and the list is growing. Yet, Americans aren't donating. He wants you to know that your corpse is going to end up looking pretty bad no matter what, so you might as well consider donating your organs when you go.
Death is a mutilating experience no matter what you do. So be generous and help the living.
What are some of the fears people have about donating their organs?
There's a number of fears, Terry, and they're culturally based. One of the great fears is that they're going to become organ and tissue donors before they really had to die. That's actually obviated in our society because the rules are is that a different medical team has to be taking care of you than the team that decides on, for example, death by brain criteria, brain death, or the team that takes your organs. That's a major fear. Others, which are about how the body is going to be treated after death, are that embalming won't be possible or an open casket funeral won't be possible if you donate your organs and tissues.
Is that true?
Not true at all. Not true at all. In fact, modern morticians are specifically trained in how to restore bodies, make them presentable, if nearly every organ and tissue that's possible to take has been taken. And they can still have the open casket funeral. And as we say, only your mortician knows for sure.
Do you find a lot of people are afraid of the pain, even though rationally they know they'd be dead by the time the organs were removed?
That doesn't seem to be a big determinant. It's more the question that, boy, the body's going to be mutilated. They've suffered enough. But in fact, the people that are suffering are the ones that need the organs and tissues to continue a full life or to have a full life. And as you said early on, no matter what you do, being dead is a mutilating experience.
Well, I want to warn our listeners that some people will be absolutely fascinated by these details, and other people will be very uncomfortable hearing them. So, listeners, be advised. I want to talk with you first about the viewing of bodies. You know, when you see a body laid out in a funeral home, it gives you the idea that you can actually be quite attractive in death, nicely dressed and made up, and people can leave the funeral saying, he looked good.
He looked good.
you give a lot of fascinating details about how this illusion of looking good is created. Let's start with how a mortician can get rid of the pain or suffering on a dead person's face.
Well, the whole industry calls it making a beautiful memory picture, which is what you've just described. They actually massage the muscles and the facial structures to allow some of the muscles to relax and to ease some of the contractures that have gone on in the facial muscles. And some of these are just postmortem changes, and some of them may have been looking like the person was in agony. But it's all smoke and mirrors, as they say. It doesn't do anything to help the person, of course. They're dead.
If rigor mortis has set in and the body has stiffened, how does the mortician move the body around? For instance, get the arms crossed across the chest?
Oh, well, sometimes, actually, it's almost impossible to do it if, depending on the state of when they get the body. But indeed, rigor mortis comes on at various times, at various speeds, and then wears off. So the body eventually does become loose. So again, it depends when the mortician actually gets the body. But they can oftentimes massage the muscles and get them into a certain position. Once they have embalmed the body, however, it often takes on fairly rigid type of position, at least for a while. And so they have to be careful about how they position the body.
Mm-hmm. One thing that really amazed me, some body parts are kept in their positions with the help of superglue or rubber cement.
Superglue has long been used by embalmers to keep eyes closed, to keep mouths closed, to do other kind of things, sealing certain holes in the body. So kind of magic.
If eyes are closed after death, will they open if they're not glued shut?
They can be partially open if they're not glued shut. They're always kept shut one way or another. There's something called an eye cap also that can be used with or without the super glue, and it's put under the eyelids, and it has little ridges on it, and it holds the tissue closed from the inside.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, that's one reason why eyes are donated so frequently, even oftentimes without family's knowledge. In some states, that's permissible. Because truly, there's no way of anyone else telling other than the mortician whether the eyes have been donated, because you're going to be putting something in to replace any eyes that are taken out. The eyes are going to always be closed.
Yeah, once a body is buried in the coffin, in a cemetery, and it hasn't, it's either not been embalmed or it's just been embalmed for the viewing. Does it decompose in the coffin?
Oh, sure. And in fact, what is thought is that these so-called hermetically sealed coffins, the real expensive ones that, you know, can go up to $6,000 or more, that are airtight, will in fact enhance decomposition, will speed it up. Sure, the body's decomposed. Now, what parts decompose first? The parts that did not have embalming fluid. In fact, there's studies going on right now by forensic anthropologists centered mainly in the Tennessee area to find out exactly how bodies that are partially embalmed, more fully embalmed, not embalmed, buried at different levels, and in different types of coverings will decompose. And that's to help forensic scientists out when they investigate bodies.
You know, the coffin doesn't decompose, right?
Well, it depends on the type of coffin. Now, Orthodox Jews, who actually have the most ecologically sound way of disposing of the body, are buried in wooden coffins without any metal in them. Those coffins decompose. They're just usually fairly plain wood, and they will decompose along with the body. Metal coffins, on the other hand, were originally not allowed in many cemeteries throughout the world because naturally they won't decompose, or at least any time within multiple generations.
So if you're in a coffin with metal in it, you don't really quite return to the earth, do you?
Not really. Not really. And that's been a real complaint of cemeterians, people who run cemeteries, as well as certain religions, because the whole idea was that it was supposed to be dust to dust.
You looked into cremation. as part of the research for your book. What is the process for cremating a body? How is it burned?
As quickly as possible. The body is not usually embalmed, except in rather unusual circumstances. It can be put in just a shroud, which is a covering, a sheet covering of the body, or more typically, it's put into some kind of box. It can be put into a large cardboard box, which the funeral directors are required to be able to supply, or into a coffin. It's then put into a crematory, the oven itself. It's turned on, and the covering, whatever the covering is burned, and the body. The remains, cremated remains, sometimes called cremains, are actually just the residual of the bone without the organic matter in there. Many funeral
is the bone the only thing that turns to ash?
Right. It's not really ash. It's actually bony remnants that are left. The only ash, as it were, is from a coffin or shroud or clothing or anything else the person had on. The other things that are left are any metal that's in the body. People say, well, I don't have any metal in my body, especially because pacemakers are usually removed because of the danger. But people have orthopedic appliances, you know, if they've had surgery. Many people now have wire sutures or staples inside their body because of surgeries they've had.
What about the fillings in your teeth?
Fillings in your teeth. They're not usually removed, and people say, well, why don't you remove the fillings? You know, they're gold or they're, you know, silver or they're other precious metals. In fact, just economically, it's not worthwhile. So they'll end up in the urn with the cremated remains. Many funeral homes, many crematories, will actually grind the remains so you don't have recognizable bone fragments left, but some don't. And you're left with 3 to 5 pounds for an adult of cremated remains.
So is the gold from your teeth going to be in that box that they send you?
Sure will.
What do people do with it? Do people ever pick that out?
Not usually, no. Uh-huh. In fact, most people... In talking with people, most of them actually do look to uh-huh. see what's in the box, whether or not they're going to be scattering it. But they don't paw through the box, and the metal will probably sink to the bottom before they actually look in the box.
My guest is Dr. Kenneth Iserzin, head of the bioethics program at the University of Arizona. He's the author of the new book, Death to Dust, What Happens to Dead Bodies. We'll be back after a break. This is Fresh Air. Back with Dr. Kenneth Iserzin, author of the new book, Death to Dust. You are, among other things, an emergency room physician. And as we said before, one of the reasons why you wrote this book is that you'd like people to think more seriously about donating their organs when they die and to be assured that their body will be mutilated whether they donate their organs or not, because, as you say, death is a mutilating experience. Are you often in the position of trying to talk to family members as somebody is dying or has just died, trying to convince the family to have that person's organs donated? That's such a sensitive subject. And what an awful time to have to talk to a family about that.
You're absolutely right. I've talked to people over my career as an emergency physician, both about donating their loved ones' organs and tissues, and also the question of autopsy when they weren't automatically a medical examiner's case. It's a terrible time to be talking to people, and in this case, people who I've never met before, because as an emergency physician, I've never met this patient, I've never met this family, you know, unlike the general practitioner or the surgeon or others who may have known these folks ahead of time. But there is a limited amount of time that's available in which to donate organs and tissues. And so we have to ask. We have to ask early on. It helps in many, many states now. They have a checkoff on the back of the driver's license. We often have driver's licenses for these people and it says, yes, I would like to donate my organs and tissues. And we show that and we ask the family whether they will go along with this person's wishes.
How do you bring it up to the family?
Well, in fact, in my situation, I have a double trouble role as it is. I first have to tell them that he has died or she has died. After that, with the same team, usually nurses, their own family support group, our chaplain, we've used our morticians who are specially trained in the past. I go ahead and would ask them, prefacing it, I guess, first with the fact that it's an awful time to be asking this, but we don't have any choice because there's a limit on time. If they want to give the gift of organs and tissues from their loved one to help others. In fact, many of them are many families are very thankful that they get asked because they want to do it, but they're not willing to bring up the subject. They may not even have thought about the subject right at that point in time, but they are glad that someone is asking. And in fact, we know from large studies, as well as personal experience, is that afterwards they feel good about that, especially, I mean, we're a major trauma center, and we see a lot of young people who tragically die. This allows them to know that many people are often helped by the donations of organs and tissues from their loved one.
So I guess a lot of people find some, if not consolation, but find something in the idea that the person who they love so much who has died will, in their death, be at least helping to save someone else's life.
Sure, because if you think about it, we're not saying they're going to help one person, but if they donate both eyes, they're going to help two people see again, mm-hmm. perhaps people hear again with ears, the ear bones that can be transplanted, skin for burn victims. By the way, maybe we should say something just about the skin. I talk to people about skin donations and they go, ugh, skin, you know. But in fact, the layer of skin that they take is no more than a sunburn that peels off in a sunburn. So it's almost nothing. And it's usually in areas like in the back where they can't see it. But they can take bones, the pancreas, now, in some cases, the intestines, certainly hearts, lungs, livers, kidneys, you know, on and on. And the list is growing.
If you want to donate your organs when you die, what plans can you make in advance for it? What do you do?
Well, as I said, most states have checkoffs on the back of their driver's licenses. But, in fact, you can also get a separate organ and tissue donor card from your local organ procurement organization. Oftentimes your hospitals, certainly the university medical centers, will have special people and they'll send you out the cards. You sign them and carry them with you. But the most important thing, absolutely, no matter what else you do, is you have to tell your loved ones that that's what you want. Because the standard of care in this country, virtually everywhere, is that if the physicians, the surgeons, are going to ask the family after you die whether they want to donate your organs and tissues, and if you've told them and explained to them why, your family, then they'll be more willing to do it. But even if you've signed, as I say, you can have a signed organ and tissue donor card in every pocket and one pasted to your forehead when you die. And if your family doesn't agree, you don't get to donate.
Are there things looking back now that you think you were naive about when you started your research for your book?
Oh, probably almost everything in there. The last book that was comprehensive about what happened to dead bodies was written 118 years ago in England. I didn't have a source to get most of this information, and I just didn't, I couldn't find the answers to almost anything. And that's, the naivety is what drove me on to write the book, is I just listed all the questions that I had. I said, I'd been dealing with corpses my entire career, and my career started before even medical school, because I drove an ambulance for 5 years. So, I mean, I've been doing this a long time. And I said, I don't know all these answers. My colleagues don't know these answers. The lay public doesn't know these answers. You know, the chaplains don't, the lawyers don't. I mean, nobody knows. And the funeral industry doesn't know all these answers either, as has been proved out. So I said, let me start looking into this. And it just kind of developed and developed into the project that turned into the book.
Do you think that the research you did for your book changed your attitude about funerals or about what you want to happen to your body after death?
Yeah, it actually did. I was somewhat ambivalent about what happened, to my body. But what I finally came to figure out is that it's really the person that's important, and I wanted kind of simplicity in what would happen to my body after death. So what I put in, and actually I put a little coda in the back of the book, because while I was writing, a lot of people were asking me, so I put a little paragraph in the back, said that when I died, just cremate the body and scatter the ashes up on what we call Finger Rock, which is part of our Catalina Mountains. I'm with search and rescue here, and spend a lot of time up in those mountains. I thought that would just be kind of nice. But you know what? And of course, that's after every organ and tissue that can be used is donated.
Mm-hmm.
That's afterwards, right? But the whole book has helped me realize even more so, it's fun to be alive. Do everything you can while you're alive to, you know, make it fun.
I know one of the reasons why you wrote this book was to tell people a lot about what happens to the body after death so that they wouldn't be afraid to donate their organs. Besides that, what's the point to you of going into the type of detail that you go into about what happens physically to a body after death?
Well, I thought there should be one source that both lay people and professionals could go to and get the answers to the questions about what happens to corpses, whether it be embalming that we talked about, or cremation, which is typical, or burials, or more strange things like cannibalism or cryonic preservation or things like that. There hasn't been any source for anybody to go to that have all that has all this information in 118 years. And so the details were important, but people don't have to read the details, of course, if they feel uncomfortable. They can read the questions about things that, or the answers to the questions about things that they don't think will really happen to them, like mm-hmm. Cannibalism, that's not going to happen to me, or getting buried at sea or you know, launched into space. And then as they feel a little more comfortable, go ahead and read the questions about things that they think may happen to them and get into those details.
Well, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
My pleasure.
Dr. Kenneth Iserzin is the author of Death to Dust, What Happens to Dead Bodies, published by Galen Press in Arizona. Iserzin directs the bioethics program at the University of Arizona. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is now available on cassette. To order, call 1-800-934-6000. That's 1-800-934-6000. The cost is $9.95 plus shipping and handling. Not all programs are available.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Borders, where the love of books and music sets the standard. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Coming up, the gentleman reporter with the Baroque style. We meet columnist Murray Kempton. He's a hero to many New York journalists. Fellow columnist Jimmy Breslin described Kempton as the man who has brought more honor to newspapers than anyone in Breslin's lifetime. Kempton has a new collection of his work called Rebellions, Perversities, and Main Events. And jazz critic Kevin Whitehead is on a different beat this week. Filling in for film critic Stephen Schiff, Kevin reviews two new college comedies, With Honors and PCU. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Korva Coleman. President Clinton says legislation banning 19 kinds of assault weapons is a no-brainer for the House of Representatives. Supporters of the ban say they need 15 more votes in the House to assure the passage of the ban. They held a news conference today to press their case. Lee Brown is the White House Drug Policy Coordinator. He says it is important that voters make their wishes known to their lawmakers on this matter.
But the most important voice Congress needs to hear this week is that of the American people. They support a ban on assault weapons 3-1. They know there's a difference between legitimate sporting weapons and those designed to kill people. They know there's no reason for criminals and thugs to be better armed than the police we put on our streets to protect the public. Members of Congress should hear the American people's voice and vote their conscience. They should do the right thing for the sake of the public, for the sake of our police officers, and certainly for the sake of our children.
A House vote on the gun ban legislation is expected this week, perhaps on Thursday. The United Nations says Bosnian Serbs are apparently blocking peacekeepers from moving. UN officials say about 160 British peacekeepers are being prevented from entering Garajda. The British are supposed to strengthen the UN peacekeepers already there. The Serbs are accusing the peacekeepers of fighting with the Bosnian Muslims. The UN vehemently denies this. Israeli Prime Minister Yitzhak Rabin and PLO Chairman Yasser Arafat will meet today in Cairo. They're resolving rather differences over the Palestinian self-rule agreement. Some last-minute problems have come up as negotiators work to finish the accord. The BBC's Simon Ingram reports from Cairo.
Arguments over the details of the autonomy agreement had always been expected to go on right up to the last minute, and that's exactly what seems to be happening. Many points agreed at earlier sessions were resolved only in principle or verbally, and the task of drafting them on paper will have given each side the opportunity to squeeze an extra concession from the other. PLO officials have accused the Israelis of reneging on more than 20 separate points. The Israelis say the Palestinians are doing just the same thing. When they meet shortly, Mr. Arafat and Israel's Prime Minister Yitzhak Rabin will have the task of settling any arguments their negotiators cannot. The list of issues confronting them could be a long one. But as the hours slip by, and with preparations for an elaborate ceremony tomorrow well advanced, the possibility of a serious delay in proceedings seems remote.
The BBC's Simon Ingram reporting. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial Average gained more than 13 points to end at 3,714. Declining issues led advancing ones by a slight margin in heavy trading. This is NPR News from Washington. President Clinton says it's time for the Haitian military rulers to go. Mr. Clinton accused the Haitian junta of murdering civilians. He's also refused to rule out any options in dealing with the military leaders. The Washington Post reports the Clinton administration is thinking about sending military trainers to Haiti. They would be armed and able to defend themselves against attacks by supporters of the Haitian rulers. The African National Congress has increased its winning margin from South Africa's all-race elections, but delays in vote counting are holding up final results. NPR's Suni Khalid reports from Durban.
The first session of the Provincial Assembly of KwaZulu-Natal on Thursday was postponed following a meeting of premier candidates from various political parties. The decision was taken because of continued delays in tabulating election results for the province, which leaves unsettled the number of seats each party will hold. The Inkatha Freedom Party holds a 53-33% lead over the African National Congress in provincial balloting in KwaZulu-Natal, with only about 24% of the vote counted. Final results have been announced for only four of South Africa's nine provinces, but a spokesman for the Independent Electoral Commission said provisional final results for the national and regional balloting, including KwaZulu-Natal, would be released by tomorrow morning. I'm Suni Khalid in Durban.
Congressional Democrats say raising interest rates won't be in the economy's best interest. The Congressional Joint Economic Committee says recent action by the Fed to raise interest rates really isn't necessary. The central bank says the increases are needed to prevent rising inflation. The Fed is currently controlled by Republican appointees. The Congressional Committee is controlled by Democrats. The committee says economic growth will continue, but it says further interest rate increases could threaten job and economic growth. The Commerce Department says its index of leading economic indicators rose 0.7% in March. Analysts say the increase is evidence the economy is expanding at a moderate pace. I'm Corva Coleman in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. The suicide of Nirvana's Kurt Cobain occurred the same week his wife, Courtney Love, was releasing an album with her band, Hole. As a result, the title of the album, Live Through This, has taken on a painful irony. But rock critic Ken Tucker says it shouldn't distract us from the quality of the music.
And the sky was made of amethyst, and all the stars were just like little fish. You should learn when to go. You should learn how to say no.
Courtney Love sings in what might be called a careful caterwaul. She has a perfectly good voice that she systematically distorts with moans and growls and leaps into awkward registers. It's a style that's equal parts Johnny Rotten and Chrissy Hynde, a post-grunge attack that makes her sound tough and vulnerable at the same time.
I want some.
Lyrics like that invite the sort of tabloid speculation that pop stars usually deplore. When Love sings so mournfully, "Where is my baby?" many listeners will be reminded of the fact that Love and her husband Cobain briefly lost custody of their baby about a year ago after a magazine reported that Love was using heroin while she was pregnant. There's a consistent unsavoriness to the lives that Love is living through and Cobain hasn't. Grim anecdotes laced with overdoses and despair. Like Kurt Cobain, Courtney Love has occasionally been able to turn that material into frighteningly effective music. The music of Courtney Love and Hole doesn't come out of nowhere. She's expressed her admiration for the Sex Pistols and the Pretenders, but I also hear her as a spiritual daughter of Patti Smith, the poet who sang strongly and angrily in a similarly fragile, wounded voice. It would double the unfortunateness of Kurt Cobain's death if Courtney Love's music isn't recognized as its own expression of a distinctive unhappiness.
Ken Tucker writes about popular culture for Entertainment Weekly. He reviewed Hole's new album, Live Through This.
Girl turns each little virus revolution coming.
This is Fresh Air. Murray Kempton is a hero to many New York journalists. Last year, in a New Yorker profile, David Remnick wrote, "Kempton is the one true original in the business. He is surely among the greatest of all living newspapermen, and yet he is for the most part a secret west of the Hudson River." Well, maybe he'll be a bit less of a secret now with the publication of his new collection, Rebellions, Perversities, and Main Events. His subjects include Karl Marx, Ronald Reagan, mobsters, the Pope, and Bessie Smith. Kempton started writing columns for the New York Post in 1949. He left that paper in 1981 for New York Newsday, where he continues to write a column at the age of 76. He's considered somewhat of an eccentric, still biking around the city in his suit. In the introduction to his book, he writes, "Dwight D. Eisenhower once bawled him out by the numbers, and Richard Nixon once did the unmerited kindness of thanking him for being so old and valued an advisor. And Joe McCarthy lied to him." But Kempton says that was hardly a unique experience.
You know, there'd be times when he'd say, "I've got a document." You'd go up to him and say, "You're going to have a document." He'd say, "It's right back here." Then he'd come back and there'd be no document. I mean, that's where, you know, he'd sort of lie. Mm-hmm. He lied on most things.
About John Kennedy, you write, "I have seen John Kennedy with the nuns, whose fidelity to their eternal wedlock to Christ he strained as no other mortal man could." What are you referring to there?
Well, I think that I have seen, and I do not, I do believe that nuns keep their vows, but around John F. Kennedy, they would bat their eyes. I can only interpret as somewhat flirtatious manner. But he combined everything, you see. He was a Catholic, sort of. And, of course, they were deeply involved with the idea of having a genuine Catholic president. So what I'm trying to say is, no, I mean, he was just incredibly attractive to women. Mm-hmm. Actually, he was also incredibly attractive to guys. I mean, I suppose to the extent that I have any loins, they're probably conventionally heterosexual. But I used to sit at these hearings of the Senate Rackets Committee where his brother Robert was general counsel, and every now and then Senator Kennedy would come in and sit beside him, and the sun would come in and would creep across the bones of these two guys. And I'm telling you, I remember thinking to myself, Jesus, what beauty. I mean, they were just incredibly attractive. And That's what I meant.
But you wouldn't write about this in those days, right?
I wouldn't write about their attractiveness to girls? I think I would, yes. I'd say they're immensely attractive young men.
Oh, okay.
But as to their personal lives, I don't know.
Have your standards changed about what to write about in people's personal lives? You said before that you used to be more intimate in your style of journalism. What changed you?
Well, I used to be, when I said intimate, I used to hazard guesses. You know, once, I used to do divorces all the time. And I went to see a very famous figure on the stand. And I was getting ready to make fun of him. And it suddenly occurred to me that my life had not been so impeccable, that if my divorce case had, I had been on the stand and was being cross-examined, that I would have suffered greatly, that this man was suffering greatly. So I got up to my feet, left, and never did a divorce case since. Now, this happened when I was quite old and had jobs and didn't have too much to worry about. But I think I was right. And I can't explain why I think I was right, but I think I was right. I mean, actually, what you should try to do in any kind of reporting, you shouldn't lie to people. you shouldn't act as though you really are more virtuous than they are. And this man was more virtuous than I was, certainly. But in any case, but you shouldn't lie to people because you have to run into them again. You shouldn't tell them, I'm on your side, I want to hear your side of the story, or anything like that. You can do a job and you can keep your honor. And, of course, I mean, it's, you know, a friend of mine once said once that he became a columnist so he wouldn't have to call up a cop's widow and say their husband had just been shot. And I understand that. I mean, there are a lot of things you have to do in journalism that you, if they're your assignment, you do them. But if you're a columnist and have a relevant amount of freedom, then it seems to me you have far less of an excuse for just invading people's privacy and just to get ahead. But I do think that I think the worst thing you can do is to lie to somebody about being on their side, partly because you're going to run into him somewhere down the road and he's going to say, you lied to me. And if you have any shame at all, you'll feel it.
When you say lying to someone, do you mean lying to someone that and pretending like you're on their side so that they'll give you good quotes and open up to you?
And open up to me.
Did you do that a lot in the earlier part of your career?
Well, I did a lot. When I was in the South, I began to realize that this was a perfectly wonderful story, which means you would see the guy again. And I took to saying to them, don't tell me anything you wouldn't like to see printed.
This is when you were covering the civil rights movement?
Yeah. I mean, you know, sheriffs and mayors, county corporation attorneys and people like that, white establishment people, or white citizens council hacks. Because I said, look, I'm trying to keep an open mind, but when I get back and start writing, my mind will close again and you can't trust me. So don't say anything you wouldn't want to see printed because I may have to come back here in a month, and I don't want you telling me I was a liar. And they talk just as well. I think you almost have to do that. You have to level with the guys you're covering.
As someone who's been writing columns for decades, do you think that there are traps that columnists often fall into if they've been writing a column for a long time, and have you tried to avoid those traps yourself?
I think they're unavoidable. I think you just, I mean, I think all of us at a certain point, certainly in my age, tend to become parodies of ourselves. You have a manner. I mean, Westbrook Pegler used to refer to what he did as packaged goods, and it was a very good, is that a metaphor, Ms. Gross? You better, whatever it is, very good image. And I think what happens is you lapse as time goes on to a series of habits, and they're very bad habits, and you really haven't got time to correct them. I think your taste improves. I hadn't thought of it this way. It's probably, you know, a consolation you don't used to have. But I remember, I mean, it seems hard to believe that I went all over the South, established a fairly good reputation. And I was drunk about 50% of the time. And when you're drunk, you really don't know that you're bad. But even when I was sober, I never knew how bad I was. I mean, I did it very carelessly. I came in from lunch, get some sort of idea. I would never do that now and just write a piece. And I was living out of town then, had to make trains. And I would write a piece in 40 or 45 minutes.
Did you think of that as part of the pose, part of the columnist pose or the reporter's pose?
Part of the reporter's pose, yeah, I think it was. I think it was a post-war pose. Not just journalists. I think everybody drank too much. It's hard for you at your age to know how much people drank. You know, I worked a year in Italy, and I stopped drinking in Italy because Italian brandy is awful. And so I never drank whiskey because whiskey wasn't available. So I stopped drinking, and I still say that I don't drink anymore. And I drink 4 bottles of beer and 1 liter of wine a day. But I don't consider that drinking because it's not hard liquor. But I remember coming home and realizing I lived in Princeton then, and I lived in suburban circles. And I suddenly realized that all my friends, you get to about 9 o'clock at night, And I realized, without naming names, that most of my friends had been absolutely drunk. And I had been absolutely drunk. And we'd be having these conversations, and my voice was traveling past his ear, and his voice was traveling past my ear. And we had these two dialogues going on because we were too drunk to know what was going on.
So you don't drink hard liquor anymore, but you still drink wine and beer. Do you drink while you're working?
No. I got out of that habit and haven't since. Mm-hmm. No, I really drink two or three beers a day. That's about all. I drink beer at night.
Everybody who reads your book seems to have, a favorite column or something that they point to. And those favorite columns are also often about either the great political figures you've written about or mobsters that you've written about in New York. A column that I found particularly interesting isn't about somebody else, it's about you. And it's a column from 1971 about how you got mugged in New York. You had the New York Times, which you just bought in your hands, and you were taking it home to your apartment on the Upper West Side in Manhattan. And on the way, you were stopped by two young men with a large, old, dirty knife, and they told you to give them all your money, or they'd cut you. And tell us what you said to them.
Well, I only had 35 cents in my pocket. Mm-hmm. So, and they patted me down. It was rather humiliating. And it was very, I don't know, it's an odd experience. But it shows the fundamental injustice of life. Because I was talking to somebody on Playboy about this happening. It's a very strange kind of feeling. I mean, I haven't been stuck up 10 years. But, you know, when these things happen, and you say what pops into your head. And I remember feeling very apologetic for not having any money. And then after this, which is, you know, the class differences which govern our society, Ms. Gross, I was talking to somebody in Playboy about it, and they said, well, you do a piece on this for me. So I wrote this particular piece for them. I had lost 35 cents in the stick-up, and I got $1,000 to write the piece.
Murray Kempton, his new collection is called Rebellions, Perversities, and Main Events. This is Fresh Air. Linda Wertheimer's with us. Linda, what's coming up on All Things Considered?
Terry Mara-Liason will be with us to talk about the Clinton policy on Haiti. And we'll have a piece from David Wellna on Haitians who back military rule despite the embargoes the U.S. has thrown at them. There's a hearing today on Capitol Hill on spying in America and on the president's proposal that the FBI and the CIA should work closely together in future. Also, a civics lesson from Ann Cooper on how the new South African government is supposed to work and a look back at U.S. policy in Africa from the man who brought us constructive engagement. And another in our series on Taft High School in Chicago, a crisis when students find out their teacher wants to quit.
Thanks, Linda. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Two new comedies about collegiate life have opened, With Honors and PCU. Guest film critic Kevin Whitehead says neither deserves very high marks.
Any student wanting to escape end-of-semester blues can safely hide out at With Honors or PCU. One indication of how realistic these campus comedies are is that a total of one teacher figures in the plot of With Honors, and none in PCU. In old-school movies, the big bummer was getting scolded in class by Professor X. In the new films, academic disaster is watching your computer crash. Not that these movies are sociologically accurate. With Honors is the story of how a wise homeless man teaches four Harvard undergraduates lessons in living they won't get from books. He's played by Joe Pesci in his first film in weeks. Joe dresses like Friar Tuck and spouts some old-world philosophy out the side of his mouth.
Women, ain't they perfect?
Not always.
Yes, they are. They're perfect. Don't matter if they're skinny, fat, blonde, or blue. If a woman is willing to give you her love, Harvey, it's the greatest gift in the world. Makes you taller, makes you smarter, makes your teeth shine. Boy, oh boy, women are perfect.
With Honors is mostly as wholesome as it is hokey. It encourages comparisons to Dead Poets Society. But it's truer to a student's worldview. In this movie, death is not for young people. Joe Pesci isn't nearly as grating as his Bowery accent. And I like the juvenile leads for whom he plays matchmaker. Brendan Fraser, star of Encino Man, who looks like a chunky Harry Connick, and Moira Kelly of the teen classic Twin Peaks Fire Walk With Me. Harvard's lone faculty member is played by Gore Vidal, Fraser's mentor until Joe Pesci comes along. In class, Vidal mocks politically correct jargon, but later he caves in where it counts. He approves the kid's senior thesis, not because of his fuzzy ideas, but because he's sincere. Conservative educators will get no comfort from the movie PCU either. The prospect of a right-wing college comedy is appealing. Such lowbrow and low-budget campus movies most always lean to the left, as they depict the class struggle between plebeian students and an entrenched power structure. PCU threatens to portray politically trendy students as heavies, but like a bad term paper, it doesn't follow through on its stated premise. It's stated by Jeremy Piven, who plays that beloved college movie type, the 30-ish undergraduate with a receding hairline.
It's a whole new ball game on campus these days, and they call it PC.
PC?
Politically correct. And it's not just politics, it's everything. It's what you eat, it's what you wear, and it's what you say. And if you don't watch yourself, you can get in a buttload of trouble. For instance,
we have rights
too. These girls?
Yeah.
No, you don't. Those are women. You call them girls, and they'll pop your figs.
That last bit is typical of the riotous humor here. The good news is George Clinton plays for the big dance. The bad news is there's dialogue like, "Oh my God, George Clinton." What's most annoying about PCU is that all the cardboard feminists, potheads, black militants, and hippie activists are extraneous to that same old story, grungy underdogs versus campus fat cats. Any flash of wit is offset by the increasingly tiresome David Spade as leader of the bad preppies. It's a tribute to PCU's intellectual rigor that, at the end, after all the students pledge universal tolerance, they immediately run right-winger Spade off campus. Then again, maybe PCU is a sly critique of eroding artistic standards. It's so up to the minute, but empty, it makes you appreciate the enduring classics, like Animal House.
Kevin Whitehead is Fresh Air's jazz critic. He's filling in for film critic Stephen Schiff. Fresh Air's interviews and reviews are produced by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, and Naomi Person, with Nancy Greenlease and Sue Spolin. Our interns are Devin Reif, Ann Neville, and Philo Holland. I'm Terry Gross.
Fresh Air is now available on cassette. To order, call 1-800-934-6000. That's 1-800-934-6000. The cost is $9.95 plus shipping and handling. Not all programs are available.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, coming of age in the decade of polyester, happy face buttons, and the Partridge Family, we talk with Pagan Kennedy, author of the new book Platforms, a microwaved cultural chronicle of the 70s. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.